This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Tom Scragg, and I'm here with Dylan Dong, who's a graduate student from Caltech in California. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dylan, what is it you're working on?
So the project that I'm talking about at this conference is a project in search of sort of what we call the gold standard of star formation. Now, this is a bit of a controversial term, right? Everybody disagrees about how best to measure star formation rates, and it's highly dependent on the kinds of galaxies that you're looking at, and the kinds of environments in particular in those galaxies that you're looking at, which method works better. But at least my talk is hoping to convince people that this particular kind of radiation that's found in the radio, called free-free radiation, or the fancy German term is Bremsstrahlung. I'm hoping to convince people that this is a good way of measuring very accurate star formation rates. Free-free radiation is what happens when you have an electron just floating around in free space, and you've got a proton or some other ionized particle with some positive charge. The electron zips right past that proton or that ion, and it gets deflected very slightly. And that very slight deflection, because remember Maxwell's laws, when you have accelerating charges, you produce radiation. That's what free-free radiation is.
And you can measure that for distant galaxies with the radio telescopes we've got now?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. Like, the improvement in instrumentation in radio telescopes over the past decade or so has really allowed us to get down to the sensitivities required to measure this kind of emission.
Why is star formation rates?
Star formation rates are an effort to sort of encapsulate this extremely complicated phenomenon of star formation itself into one number. And that one number says, you know, in this location, in this galaxy, or maybe this portion of this galaxy, how many times the mass of the sun is forming every year. And this number can tell us lots of things. So really high star formation rates, for example, mean that you'll have lots of supernovae going off every year. And supernovae inject a ton of energy into the galaxy, and they can blow out big gas outflows, and it can really affect the course of galaxy evolution.
If you're looking at other galaxies, you're starting to look back in time, the time it takes the signal to come to Earth. So do you see different rates at different ages of the universe?
Yes, you do. So my actual work is focused on very recent star formation in relatively nearby galaxies. But it's really interesting to look at galaxies that are farther away, and therefore, you know, the star formation occurred earlier in the universe's history. And it turns out that if you zoom all the way back to maybe 10 billion years ago, star formation rates were drastically higher throughout the universe than what you see today.
Presumably, there's a lot more free gas around.
Mm-hmm.
And you get bigger stars, and they burn out more quickly.
Yeah.
How did you get into this area?
I started on this project, actually, my first summer as an undergraduate. I got this internship at the Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, and this guy who's working there, Eric Murphy, decided to, you know, take a chance on this freshman and undergraduate, basically, who knew absolutely nothing. And he and, you know, a bunch of our other collaborators, like Emmanuel Momjian, basically taught me everything I know and allowed me to really grow as a scientist through this project.
This is your first international conference, or have you been to other ones?
This is my first international conference, yes. I've been to a few in America, but it's the first time I've traveled. Yeah, so I actually did a master's degree at Cambridge last year, and so it was a really convenient time because I never got a chance to actually do the actual graduation ceremony, and so I got to combine, you know, coming to the UK for this conference with coming to Cambridge to kneel down in Senate Hall and have Latin words that I don't understand spoken at me.
So what's the plan for the coming year? Do you have an observation schedule? Are you looking at new data? Or is it data previously taken and then we're starting to analyze it?
Yeah, so it's data previously taken that we're starting to analyze. And one of the things that about radio data is that there are a lot of complications in analyzing the data. There's lots of calibration work that's involved, and that's really mostly what I worked on as an undergraduate. And now we're finally getting to the point where we've got good usable science data, and we're going to start comparing it to, for example, other ways of tracing star formation rates and getting science results out of that.
So you raise an interesting point. We don't typically talk about the mechanics of the mm-hmm. work that we do. But you talked about calibration and calibrating the data.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a set of radio signals. How do you calibrate it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the instrument that I use is the VLA, or the Very Large Array. And it's a set of 27 radio dishes that are located in the high plains of New Mexico. And what you do is you point all of these dishes at the same target, and you look at the differences in the signals that are coming to each of these dishes. And there's some fancy maths. There's some Fourier transforms and all that rigmarole. You can turn this data into images, which is what you might see, what you might get directly out of, say, an optical telescope. But this entire process from getting the raw data coming into each telescope and turning that into usable images requires a lot of calibration. So, for example, you need to observe sources where you know how the source is supposed to behave. So you have to observe a flux calibrator, for example, which you know exactly how bright it should be in this band, in order to know how bright the thing you actually are trying to observe is. You have to observe a phase calibrator to calibrate one of these essential components of interferometry, which is the phase, and tells you where things are located on the sky.
Is it always images that you're looking at, or do you look at the raw data and process that to get the star formation rates?
Yeah, so I think that would be a really interesting avenue to explore, just getting the starting from the actual data that comes out of the interferometer. And perhaps it's a better way to do things. Although I think that most astronomers, myself included, typically only work from the image data. But it's definitely something that we want to look into.
Do you get to spend time up in New Mexico at the observatory, or is it all remote in an office somewhere?
Yeah, it's mostly remote in an office. So the VLA is such a complicated instrument, and many billion-dollar instrument, that they wouldn't let students like me put their grubby little hands on the controls. They have professional telescope operators. So what you do is, you know, you tell them what you want to observe, you send in a proposal, and you tell them exactly the schedule of objects to observe, and they slot that into the instrument scheduler, and they find the most opportune time to observe your targets. And at some point, after they've observed your targets, then you get an email saying your data is ready. And now's where, you know, my work begins, where I have to download that data and do some calibration, do some imaging, and hopefully get some science out of it.
In your talk, you're talking about different frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason to look at different frequencies?
Well, it's not that some are better than others, but every frequency is a unique window on the universe, on the object that you're trying to understand. So, for example, my talk addresses five different kinds of light. Three are just radio frequencies. So I've got 3 gigahertz observations, I've got 15 gigahertz observations, and 33 gigahertz in the radio. And I'm also looking at this particular transition of the hydrogen atom called H-alpha, and this particular part of the infrared spectrum, which is the Spitzer 24 micron band. And each one of these can be used by itself in some way to measure the star formation rate. However, when you compare all of these together, you can really get at the differences between each one of these. So in particular, what I'm doing with the 3 radio frequencies is I'm trying to disentangle the effects of 2 different kinds of emission. So there's the free radiation, which we talked about earlier, which is free ions and free electrons zipping past each other. There's synchrotron radiation, which are these extremely relativistic, so electrons that are traveling close to the speed of light and orbiting around these weak galactic magnetic fields. And so these two components are very hard to disentangle from each other, but each one of them tells you a different story about the star formation activity that happened. So free-free radiation directly traces the ionized gas around regions which are star-forming. And synchrotron radiation is more of an indirect tracer, where when you have star formation activity, you get supernovae, and those supernovae accelerate these extremely high-energy electrons. The kinds of star-forming regions that I'm looking at are in nearby galaxies. So they're not so far away that all you can see is, you know, the entire galaxy in one pixel, but they're also not so close that you can actually do the right thing to do, which is to count stars, right? All the stars are blended together into one pixel. You may even be blending together multiple star-forming regions into one pixel. So what you have to do is you have to look not spatially, but you have to look at different wavelengths to be able to disentangle the multiple effects that you see from star formation. And so, in particular, the stars that we do look at are the really massive stars. They're the ones that are like 10, 20, 30 times the mass of our sun. And those stars are hot, they're blue, they produce tons of ultraviolet photons. And some of those ultraviolet photons, if they have high enough energy, are able to ionize hydrogen. So they're able to take a neutral hydrogen atom with a proton and electron bound to each other and just eject that electron into space. And that electron just floats around in this soup, this plasma, around the star-forming region. And the three different kinds of tracers measure various effects of these high-mass stars. So the radio, as I was saying earlier, measures primarily at the high frequencies. The radio measures primarily the effects of when those electrons zip by the protons. H-alpha, which is one of the what's called recombination lines of hydrogen, measures when the electron joins back together with the proton and gives off some light. And 24 microns is really just a proxy for the total infrared emission. And the total infrared emission, it tells you something not about the gas itself, but about the dust, about the molecules that are floating around the star-forming region. So one of the problems with H-alpha in particular is that even though it's easy to measure, we don't know how much dust is in between us and that region. And those H-alpha photons tends to be absorbed by the dust in a process called extinction. And so the real advantage of my work, which is done in the radio, is that radio measures the exact same electrons and protons that are floating around the soup as H-alpha, but the radio is long wavelength enough that it completely just passes right through the dust. Like, it's really dramatic.
Okay. So you mentioned extinction. That's like looking at the sun through clouds. The thicker the clouds, or the thicker the dust in this case, the less the light gets through. So
yeah, exactly.
You mentioned recombination lines, plural. So if you get an electron combining with a proton, why are they multiple lines?
Ah, yeah. So this comes from quantum mechanics. You have a proton, and an electron can sit at sort of different energy levels, and there's a minimum energy level called the ground state, and there's and that's the n equals 1 state, and then there's a higher energy level, n equals 2, another higher energy level, n equals 3, all the way up to n equals infinity, and I hope I'm getting this right. I think H alpha is the n equals 3 to n equals 2 transition of the electron.
Okay, so when the electrons and the protons come together, they'll come together at the outermost limit and then gradually, you know, like falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
Go energy level to energy level.
One step
to another. Okay. Yep. And you can detect that?
Yeah, you can.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's cool technology.
You're talking about multiple traces.
Oh, so the other one that I was looking at particularly in my work was 24 microns, which is really a proxy for the light that's given off by the dust, as opposed to by the soup that I was talking about earlier. And why is there light given off by the dust? because the dust has absorbed a lot of this energy that was coming from the stars, that was coming from the H-alpha that was slamming into the dust. And so one thing that people have done is they've combined the H-alpha photons that actually do manage to escape a star-forming region and head towards Earth with the light that comes from the dust of the photons that did not escape. And if you combine those two, then you can get a sense of the total amount of H-alpha that was produced. And it turns out this is a very good way of doing it. But to really confirm it, we want a direct and extinction-free way of measuring star formation, and that's what I do in the radio.
Okay, why look at galaxies far away then? You mentioned because they are far away, mm-hmm. you get a single pixel. Do you compare with closer galaxies to say, okay, this is how the process works and these are the relative values in different regions?
Yeah. So really our knowledge of galaxies far away comes from our knowledge of nearby galaxies. We have to look at the things that we can study in detail and really understand the processes that are going on over there in order to be able to extrapolate to things that we can't study in as much detail. So, you know, the work that I do really has its foundation in work that people were doing in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s looking at star-forming regions in our own galaxy. But you can't just restrict our knowledge to our own galaxy, because there are all sorts of crazy, complicated phenomena that go on in the universe, and not all of them happen in our own galaxy. We need to look at the full range of environments in order to understand, you know, all this beauty that's going on in the universe.
Okay. There's a lot of people at the conference. Have you made contacts, friends, people you can talk to that are covering the same sort of field you're covering?
Oh, yeah. It's been great just hearing everybody's talks. We'd had a ton of amazing talks at this conference. In particular, there are lots of experts who have been doing the kinds of things that I've been thinking of doing as well. So a lot of people have been doing what's called Markov chain Monte Carlo modeling, and this is an essential statistical tool, I think, for being able to do the separation that I was talking about earlier between synchrotron emission and free-free emission. So I've really had great conversations with people doing that. There are, of course, you know, experts in the physics of what goes on in star-forming regions, and it's great to learn from their wisdom as well. And overall, you know, it's just nice when you have so much expertise in this one particular subject concentrated in one place.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dylan. That's been really interesting. I hope we see you again sometime.
Thank you.